Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Building It Up with Bertelsmann, India's first podcast that focuses on the growth pangs of a startup. I am Ankur Variku, your host for today, and I have Ashwin and Pankaj, two very distinguished gentlemen in the HR and EdTech space in this country. Ashwin Ajila is the co-founder and managing director of iNurture, a Bertelsmann India investment, and he started iNurture in 2009. Today, it is India's largest network of campus programs across the country, and they run certification programs that helps ambitious industry professionals to skill up in various new age domains and accelerate their career programs. Pankaj Bansal, my second guest for today, is co-founder and CEO of PeopleStrong, which he started in 2006. PeopleStrong today is India's undisputedly biggest HR tech company, and Pankaj comes with a fantastic array of HR experience while he also manages a HR fund. Today's episode will focus on HR and EdTech as businesses. So if you're an entrepreneur that is in these two rather difficult businesses to be in, then you cannot wait to hear from Ashwin and Pankaj. We're going to focus on what it takes to scale the business from 10 to 100. What are the opportunities and the challenges that most HR and EdTech companies face in this country? And also alongside focus on the fact that if you are a founder that runs a business that employs people at large scale, think of delivery networks, logistics networks, then how is it that you start thinking of that as well? Thank you so much, Ashwin and Pankaj, joining us for the podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. So I'll start with you, Ashwin. You've been in the business of education and education tech for a long time, and iNurture is what you represent. There has been for the longest time this conversation in India that most of the graduates coming out of our colleges today are largely unemployable. And you have been in the business of giving them certificate programs to get them to the skills that they should ought to have to represent our industry. How do you see that changing? And predominantly in the fact of how have things changed from where you began to where they are today, particularly the Indian environment and the current graduate scenario that you experience?
I think the very basic of iNurture was to try and build a bridge between the industry and the academia.
Yeah.
Typical challenges that the industry faced was that how do you deal with 30,000 colleges and 700 universities? Yeah. They don't have the bandwidth to do that. Because the real problem comes from the fact that it's a very regulated market, higher education. In fact, higher education is more regulated than the K-12 space. Yeah. And because of the regulations, and the two things, one is the stringent regulation and the lack of understanding of the regulation itself by, universities and colleges was the real problem. Mm-hmm. While industry moved on and technology moved on, if you look at our curriculums today, I mean, let's take a basic computer science program. The softwares that are still taught in the program are actually they're obsolete. Yeah. I mean, industry is not using that. So, sure. I mean, where is the question of them being employable? So I think the fact is that, regulation could be good for the industry, but when it's completely regulated and the regulatory bodies itself don't have an understanding of what industry needs, I think, it's going to be a huge problem when it comes to employability. Okay. So the fact is two things. One is, the curriculums have not changed for the last 10, 15 years. Two, even the pedagogy that is allowed, in most international campuses, is again restricted by the regulatory bodies. When I say restricted, I mean things like, what EdTech interventions can you have? Now, when the curriculum is outdated, the interventions have to be much larger. A simple example is that till last year, tech intervention was not allowed as part of the curriculum.
Really?
It had to be done outside the curriculum. Wow. Today, the government has come back and said you can do 10% in certain programs, you can do 20%. But then, when you regulate what a campus can do when it comes to the interventions, you're going to have a problem because you can do something, but you can't do enough. Mm. The second problem was theory versus practical. Mm. What is the biggest complaint that industry has today? Mm. The problem is that they're saying, yes, they're good at theory, but they're not industry ready because they have not actually gone through any practical experience. Yep. The regulation says that 80% of your teaching has to be classroom and theory. 20% has to be practical. Now, when the regulatory body defines something that goes against what is required in the industry, you know, you're bound to have a bound to have a problem.
Correct.
Though now the government has come up with some autonomy, but you know, so the 800 universities have some autonomy, not complete autonomy, but the 35,000 colleges have to blindly follow the curriculum of the overarching university that's giving the degree. So they have absolutely no flexibility in, you know, changing curriculums that are obsolete.
And in building iNurture, Ashwin, have you found over years more? Or let me ask the question differently. Have you found the students to be yearning for what you're offering more so? Or is it that the colleges have adopted this because either it's regulated or mandated by the government, or that they're also beginning to feel that it's the right value add for the students?
See, I think it's kind of a bit of the problem lies both in to some extent, and I think the least extent is the student. See, if you look at, you know, our entire education system, all of the technology interventions that came in, or the adoption of technology, happened faster in the K-12 space than in higher education.
True.
So students that are coming out from the K-12 space are very, very comfortable with technology. But unfortunately, one, the regulatory bodies have defined what tech you can use in the classroom. I mean, in some cases, you're not allowed to use tech. And two, the biggest problem are faculties. Now, faculties are not trained. To, you know, to understand the benefit of bringing in technology into the classroom.
Right.
So the real problem lies not with the students. The students are hungry. They expect to have technology in the classroom. But sometimes the management, the government, or the faculty are really the roadblock when they're trying to introduce technology. So I think what we need to do is that what we're doing at iNurture is making all of our faculties very comfortable, showing them the benefits of what technology can do for them, and that technology is the future of education. And if they're not with it, they're out of it.
And I'd love to pose this question to both of you, and I've always been intrigued. Do you think that there is case in India for private education to pick up in far bigger ways than it has in the past? What I mean to say by that is, at least being an entrepreneur, I don't think I differentiate between someone who has an AICTE degree, recognized degree, as someone who's done the right kind of course from, say, even Udemy or Udacity or so on. Do you find that corporates are also behaving this way largely? And if yes, there is business case or an opportunity in the education space.
If I just pick up this, the biggest stakeholder is not corporate, but it's the parent.
Yes.
So let's look at it. Last 3 years, the number of parents who've taken the kids out of the mainstream school and put on homeschooling. We're not realizing.
Really?
But it's a big shift. Big shift means they are sending kids for undergraduate programs to the best of the universities in the world, but after preparing them through a homeschooling process, not a standard CBSE, ICSE content.
Interesting.
Number two, have you noticed that science, commerce, and arts were the ways or words discussed a decade ago? Today, kids take science, means chemistry, along with psychology, right? So that's second thing which is being broken. And third, hence, the organizations anyway do not care about degrees beyond a point.
Sure.
I'm not saying that the top institutions won't have employability better than others. That will always be the case. But I'm saying in general, people are looking at specialties, people are looking at your skills, not necessarily degrees that are supporting it. So I'm a great fan. I believe maximum a decade, the CBSE, ICSE monopoly, the CAFE, the board for education will be relooking at the whole education framework. This won't last. That's my view.
And that then brings in a phenomenal opportunity set for entrepreneurs to think about this space, because I don't think international startup can do justice to what the Indian requirement is from an education perspective.
Ankur, don't let school interfere in the education. Very simple, right? We should not just let that happen.
School and government.
Your point of view, Ashwin?
I agree to some extent what Pankaj is saying, that there is a shift that is happening into more homeschooling. But not... If you look at the percentage of doing homeschooling, it's still a drop in the ocean.
Sure.
I'll give you an example. I mean, I'll give you two examples. When we first started iNurture itself and we launched the very first degree in animation, right, we realized that if we went under the regulated body, there were a lot of things that we had to do that had no connection to animation or no connection to the job.
Okay.
But a whole year was spent doing all of the subjects because the government decided 15 years ago that you need to do it. Now, when we launched animation as a diploma, there were hundreds of parents who came and said, you know, this is good because my son is creative, but now there's finally a course, but where is the degree?
Yeah.
right? Because culturally, I think for us, all of us as parents, is that, is there a degree? Is sure. my son a graduate? Sure. Is my son a postgraduate? Sure. Now, talking about the multidisciplinary thing that's coming in, the government has started to use and made it mandatory. But what are the credits given to multidisciplinary? Two credits, four credits, or 160 credits? And they have defined what the multidisciplinary should be. And sometimes it has no connection to the program itself. So that's our biggest challenge that we are facing today. And even when you offer international courses, now iNurture has got into a model where global schools are coming to India and working with us to set up schools. But those students are coming because of the brand of the international market. They are not accepting a diploma from those schools. They want an Indian degree attached to it. So I think that's going to be a challenge unless the mindset changes that it's not about the degree, but it's about the job, you know, at the end of the day.
Pankaj, People Strong, definitely one of the most recognized companies that it comes to when one thinks of HR tech. And a lot has happened in just how organizations have thought of HR. Suddenly, the annual appraisal process is not the cool thing to do. Suddenly, employee engagement is the buzzword. Suddenly, seeking feedback, having one-on-ones on a regular basis, continuous feedback is. Do you see mostly large companies and more so non-Indian companies adopting that better than Indian companies? Or do you not see any difference and it's perhaps just happening all across at the same pace?
It's amazing that, you know, if I look at People Strong journey, my early adopters were not necessarily the MNCs, but then Indian entrepreneurs who were trying to bring in the change in the workforce and work practices. 90% of my customers who were the first experimental customers, let me put it, at that time when no one else was adopting even cloud. I remember traditionally ERPs were up against us. And the first adoption that happened was not in multinational companies, but by Indian entrepreneurs. Even if I give you examples of large corporations like Future Group. So I remember it was Kishore Biyani sitting on the table taking a call that I want to put my people practices and people agenda ahead of anything else. And I don't care what MNCs are doing. So MNCs somewhere, Ankur, whether we like it or not, are governed a lot by their global systems and phenomena. And I'm not saying that's wrong. They are doing very progressive things across. However, Indian players have a great advantage because they can take those calls locally. They have great innovation happening here in Indian ground, and they're breaking many, many monopolies of future.
Interesting. And is this usually, in your opinion, a CHRO / CEO led intervention, or is it a realization on their part because the employees demand such a forum or a platform for their engagement?
So I'll just give you some numbers to give you a perspective. So typically, just let's look at India. India market has always been seen as CHRO deciding what to do next. Suddenly, most of the technology decisions are being made by the user. And user is not HR department, not CXO, but the employee. If you buy a technology which an employee is going to use 98% of the time, why that 2% of the time which will be used by HR department will take a call? So almost 5 out of 10 cases, CHROs have mandated that their group of employees will be deciding the technology that they will buy, which is a very new trend that I have witnessed. So it means user is being put to the center. What is the definition of design thinking? Placing user at the center. So whether we like it or not, HR has adopted by force or by choice design thinking, and that's why they've placed user at the center.
But tell me this, and I'm curious. If I am a HR tech startup founder, how do I approach my sales journey? Do I focus on B2B, CHRO, CXO-led agenda, or do I make myself a brand that employees want to sign up for or want to live in? What kind of a sales and marketing strategy?
So I'm going to take a couple of minutes for this, right?
Yes,
so,
please.
So let me tell you, you are in a tough game when you start this, because it sounds very nice when we say we have billion plus people in India. But only 450, or some estimates said 580, is the workforce of India. Out of that, only and only 10 to 12% is organized, which is a very meager number. At best, you can add it up to 6 million. Some says it's 60 million. Some says it's 70, 80 million. That's the workforce that you're talking, which will adopt your HR tech, number one. Number two, once you look at that 60, 70 million, a lot of it is in government. Right? So a lot of it is in private. So the market is further small. I'm not trying to discourage you, but just telling you the facts. Number two, 34 billion is what the number has been quoted. With great difficulty, it took us 6 months to find this number. Globally for HR tech market, out of that, only 6.7 is for Asia.
Wow.
Out of that 6.7, 1.7 for India, it's just 1 billion. now billion is not less. Yeah. Billion is a decent number. Yeah. But in this journey towards billion, an entrepreneur has to do a lot of things. When he or she thinks of a strategy, they must remember that traditional ERPs are up against them.
Yes.
So you are no one, yes. Right? They have the kind of budgets and reach that you will never have.
Yes.
So what is the way to go about it? First, if you're in early stage, please try cowboy approach, as I call it. Your charisma, your trust, your investor network will help you. If you are beyond a VC stage and you're on a PE level, then you'll be stupid and foolish, which many of us have done, including myself, thinking that you'll continue to deploy that cowboy sales approach. I think that doesn't work. Then the number, the economy is kicking. So you have to find the senior VPs of sales who will go in a very process-oriented manner, looking at 30 funnel, finding 5 bids, going for one, the standard processes kicking. So I think that's the difference between a VC-funded company and a PE-funded company. Sure. You can't run on cowboy.
Yeah.
You have to run in a very structured sales. And last is, science of sales is different from the art of sales.
Mm-hmm.
So there are new ways which are coming up. You have to look at your pre-sales solutioning engine from finding the data. So India has, at best, you will get any given point of time, 4,000 to 4,500 mid-size and above companies. Yeah. That's it. That's your universe. If there are 8 CXOs there, so 5,000 into 8 is 40,000. Your first step is to find those 40,000 people and then go after them.
Wonderful.
So that's the logic.
That's like a book out there. Thank you.
Yeah.
And do you have similar experiences, Ashwin, where building an education and an education tech company in India is considered to be really hard? And who do you sell to? Is it students? Is it parents? Is it colleges? Is it the government?
Yeah.
All?
But this is more the eye nurture challenges that we faced. If you know, when we launched in 2008, 2009, the first 5 years, we literally signed one university a year.
Wow.
And the challenge was not that, because one, the model was unique. So when something is unique, your challenges are going to be greater. So the response that we got was, who's iNurture? And the fact is, in our model, end of the day, the student is owned by the university.
Yeah.
Right? So if something was wrong, it's never iNurture that's going to be blamed. It's going to be the university. Two is that, because like what I said earlier, the university is not understanding the regulations well enough. There was always this concern that, you know, is this allowed by regulation, right? And the third is that, you know, because of the legacy mindset that a lot of these universities have, unless you put your entire pitch in a manner that they will clearly understand to 98% of what you are saying, they'd rather not try and understand and just say this doesn't work.
The default is no.
Yeah. And you know, one of the mistakes that we made very early, you know, which we thought was the right way to do it, was to approach, for instance, in a university, the head of the department and say, do you think this looks good, you know, within your department? But unfortunately, what happened was that they actually saw us as a threat. They said, if these guys come in with programs in cloud and security, you know, soon I'll be, you know, irrelevant. So they would just say no. So it's only when the management, somebody understands what's good for the university itself, rather than more about myself and where do I stand if these guys come in. So that were some of the biggest concerns. So it took us 5 years to actually address all of those concerns. You know, these guys saying they're going to make students more employable. Mm-hmm. They're going to get the faculties.
Yeah.
So once we proved that, I mean, since then, you know, we are able to pick and choose the partners that we want.
Okay.
But again, our growth is constrained because one of the regulatory aspects is that for every 20 students, you need a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're offering programs like IoT and cloud and artificial intelligence, where are you going to get PhDs? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's one of the biggest challenges that we faced.
I want to take you back, Ashwin, to the early days of iNurture, and this is the question which is almost this chicken and egg problem that could be classical for education. You do run a education company, which means that content or the syllabus and the pedagogy, all of that have to be immaculately defined. But at the same time, you have to sell that as well. And there is a massive upfront cost for developing all of this without knowing whether it's being received well. In your case, hey, who's to say that the HOD will say, no, you're a threat, and suddenly all the hard work has gone down. How do you find that balance early on when you have to decide that this bare minimum good quality content is necessary for me to even go out, and putting in the sales effort for something that you might just realize is not working as well as you thought?
Yeah, so I think like I said, I mean, going back to what I said earlier, you know, being unique has various challenges. So, but fortunately for us, from, you know, we launched in 2008. Even before we launched, you know, people understood. I think that's one thing that, you know, people should look at, you know, is there a need, right? Whether it's going to be successful or not is a different question,
sure,
right? So we understood, because I come from a family that runs universities in Bangalore. So I knew what good education could do.
Got it.
But the challenge that what industry had while talking to universities on employability is that it's not our job to talk to 30 guys. So even they were looking for somebody who could do that. So initially, you know, of course, I mean, to build something that was acceptable, that was actually, you know, doing what it said it was doing, there was a huge investment that was required. But fortunately for me, because everyone understood that there is this problem of employability, somebody needs to do something. And is there a model that will actually address this problem? But I think the other good thing that we had with our investors was that they knew this is not something that you put in 1 rupee today and it's going to be 2 rupees tomorrow. It's a long haul. You have to prove yourself and then you'll get profitable. And it took us 6 years to get profitable, right? Because we knew that we had to invest into every program that we offered. And when you offer, you know, 32 programs, that's a huge investment that, that you're making. But on both sides, that is on the industry as well as investors, everybody knew that there needs to be a model that's going to address those challenges.
Okay.
It was a long haul and came through.
Came through. Pankaj, a similar question, but slightly broad basing it, not limiting it just to HR tech.
Sure.
When it comes to B2B tech, do you sell what you've made?
That am I going to sell the product that I've built, or I'm going to build the product what they want, right? So my belief is that eventually you succeed or you become profitable when you sell what you've made. Correct. Now, is it an easy journey? It's not an easy journey. First time when you take a release, any customer will say you've built something crap, right? So that's the story of every product entrepreneur. But that shouldn't discourage you, because if there is any other model, it's not scalable. You'll pick up the story of Freshdesk, you pick up the story of Salesforce. The only difference that's happening is smarter players, cloud players, new players who are challenging the traditional ERPs, their fundamental premise is that I'll make the system so configurable. That you will give the feeling that you can control everything. And number two, you will kick out customization from the window. If customization is like a plague, that's what the traditional ERPs thrived on, because they made money out of it. Implementation agencies, their whole thing. But they also realize that they can't survive on it. So if you want to succeed and become a champion there, you have to follow a configurability route, which means your architecture should be better. You can't run on old systems. You have to be on microservices. You can't run basically old ways of selling. You'll have to find newer ways of selling. You will have to focus on users, not only on the buyer, which is a traditional mistake most of the B2B players did. So all these three things, I believe, will help.
I was keen to have your views on as well. There is this entire industry that is growing in India, which is largely driven by employability at large scale. And this is not hundreds of people. This is now 30 and 40,000 people. So the last time we saw in India this wave, it was, say, the IT sector, where suddenly there were 100,000 people all recruited. And we have those stories of people going to campuses and just picking up everyone who's graduating. And we see something similar, but it's a very big difference. I would call them, for lack of better words, blue-collar jobs. The Uber, Ola economy, the food delivery economy, the gig economy in general. People who are not permanent employees of a setup, and yet the company is responsible for hiring in thousands. How does an entrepreneur begin to think of scaling this kind of business up? Because it's driven by so many challenges. Attrition is a challenge. Training is a challenge. Just compensation and understanding performance itself is a challenge. I was speaking to, I remember, Dipinder of Zomato, and I was telling him, "Now, how's it going?" And he's like, "No, I am an ops company. I'm not a food review company anymore. I am an out and out ops company." And that's so true, because that's what you need, the absolute granularity of what is happening at the last mile.
So look at US. US has probably 20% of its workforce moving into gig already, right? Look at India number. We don't have numbers. And the temping companies we confuse with gig company. Gig is not a temp manpower service provider who give you so-called flexi workforce. It's just that their salary is being processed by them. They're still a permanent classical old correct. Employee, right? They're correct. Contractors.
Exactly.
I'm not referring to the contractors of India. I'm referring to gig when I, as an employee, can offer my service to three corporates at the same time, get paid for it.
Yeah.
And that's the world. Who wants to hold a large number? Meet any entrepreneur, and you will rarely meet someone who will say, okay, I'll deploy more people. Yeah. Their first answer is, can I find someone who can do this for me and I'll pay them?
Yeah.
The challenge that India has, we don't have labor laws around it.
Mm-hmm.
There is no social security. Even for permanent employees, we are struggling. So we have nothing for gig. Number two, the infra, I call it the capitalist infra, which is like, can I calculate their payroll?
Mm-hmm.
Can I look at their leave systems? I have nothing available with me.
Yeah.
And number three, the social stigmas around it. So people are still not very comfortable, but people in the age bracket of Ankur 40, especially in IT companies, are being forced to become gig workers.
Wow.
And you will see a new economy flourishing in India. That's the hope. That's the jobs which will come in India.
And do you see or foresee some industries adapting this faster than the others?
So all the delivery economies that you said, they are absolutely fine, because on weekends when the traffic increases, they're ready to deploy people like this. So they are the first ones.
Correct.
Second is some of the verticals like marketing and digital. People are going completely. They know there are not enough specialists available. So they are being forced to share the resource with multiple organizations. So that there are two categories. One is the so-called, as you mentioned, blue collar or jobs which are repetitive in nature will be done. Second is very specialized jobs. Both the places you will see gig coming into the first. And thirdly, some nature of work. So a lot of youngsters are becoming cool by saying that I'm going to work like a gig worker. And Bangalore is the hub. Go and see people there. They're very, very open for it. That's the first geo that I saw some fruits of gig coming up.
Nice. Do you, Ashwin, see students wanting to get skilled in a multidisciplinary fashion?
You know, I mean, if you looked at the students that are going, you know, to the US or the UK or even campuses like Ashoka and Flame, it's the need for the multidisciplinary, you know. But my concern on that is that, you know, on one side, you have this very strong employability, you know, happening. And on the other side, there is a need where people say you should find yourself before. So I'm a little confused with this finding yourself kind of thing. So we don't address that right now, but I think there is a big demand. It's happening. A lot of the colleges are now looking to set up liberal arts and humanities because students are asking for it. Now, to comment on whether that's the way forward or not is, I think the real challenge lies between, you know, employability versus finding yourself.
So I'm a believer it's coming. It may take 2 years or it may take 5 years. Time will tell.
Great. One final question before we wind up, and let me start with you, Pankaj. So you also run an HR fund.
Yes.
And you've been privileged to closely witness what is the latest technology around HR and so on.
Right.
So what are the emerging areas for entrepreneurs who are looking at HR and HR tech in general that you're particularly excited about or you think there is massive potential?
Yeah, so if I have $1 billion and I have to invest and I have 100 entrepreneurs, I'll pick up the 10 who are investing in gig kind of tech, like build up payroll software systems which can take care of gig, build up social security systems. So that's one. Second is I look at blockchains for HR. There is nothing that exists today. And I know blockchains require a bit of not-for-profit approach in this context because you'll have to aggregate a lot of players. That's the second thing that I would love HR entrepreneurs to think. And third is what I call the learning and development space. There is a lot happening, but learning and development and ed tech is going to get smudged over the next few years. Both will become same. I feel the way corporate employees will learn and the students will learn will be exactly the same. And whosoever will crack that will be the next billionaire of HR tech.
Nice.
Right. So these are the three areas I am very bullish about and I would love to invest in if I have money.
Nice. Great. Ashwin, to you.
So when we went to them and said, you know, why BTech and not BCA, they said, that's the strategy.
Yeah.
That's the policy.
Yeah.
Right. So we would look at any tech companies because I think the tech interventions are coming very strong, right? And so anything that, you know, supplements and helps us to, you know, take it to the next level in the sense that it bridges that gap between what industry wants, you know, looking at acquiring or doing joint ventures in India to take it forward.
Got so it. Wonderful. Great. Thank you so much. I love the enthusiasm, the optimism and the emotions in the room. And this made for a really engaging conversation. Thank you both of you again for
thank
being
you.
Part
thank
of
you
this.
So much, Ankur.
This is really fun. Thank you so
you.
Much.
Thank you.
And with this, we come to yet another episode's end. This was a fascinating one. I learned so much from Pankaj's numbers, from Ashwin's experience, and I hope you all also enjoyed this episode just as much as I did. Please subscribe to Building It Up with Bertelsmann on iTunes, Savan, SoundCloud, so that you are on top of every new episode that we launch, and I cannot wait to share with you the next guest that comes on Building It Up with Bertelsmann.